Back to the library today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversations, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. We know what a research scientist is, but what is a research librarian? And Earl will tell us on Scribble.
I believe that was a cue. What is a research librarian?
Well, a research librarian is sort of the newer terminology for what was formerly called a reference librarian.
Oh, okay. But
we've found, particularly working with college students, the word reference is not as widely understood by the college-age student as it used to be. So throughout the profession, not just at Augustana, there have been conversations about how to retitle formerly reference librarians so that it's more clear to students what our job is. So here at Augustana, my full title is actually research and instruction librarian, because we both teach students, but we also encourage them to develop their research skills for their academic work and also their lifelong learning.
Well, you don't do research for them, do you?
No. And much to their dismay sometimes, they will come to the research help desk, and despite trying to prepare them in the classroom, saying, you know, we're not going to really do the work for you, but there's something about the process of helping students answer their questions that's almost like solving a mystery or finding the answer to a puzzle, where I'm always finding myself personally invested in whatever their question is, even though it wasn't mine maybe 30 seconds ago.
Oh, like, yeah, I never thought of that either. I don't know. It's a brave new world, but reference librarians were always the oracles. Those are the people you talk to, and they had all the answers.
That was before Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I would have thought Wikipedia might have done you out of a job.
You know, it's actually made it more complicated because
yes.
the wealth of information that's so quickly and freely available has not only made students feel like they do know the answers. So our first job is often to kind of show them that they might not know what they think they know, but then also encourage them not to rely on Wikipedia as the final source of information. It can lead you to good things, certainly. Some Wikipedia articles are very well-referenced and well-cited.
Well, I didn't realize that Wikipedia is gradually getting corrected. One of my son's hobbies is correcting Wikipedia on things that he knows more than the... And the Wikipedia puts that in, doesn't it? That the changes.
Well, the problem is that if you don't like what Wikipedia says, you just put in something else.
Well, they must check on that. I don't know.
There is actually a subfield within the field of anthropology that is studying Wikipedians,
really?
And the way that they share information, and they do sometimes gather in real life. They have Wikipedia conventions. The library, in conjunction with Augustana's ITS, hosted a Wikipedia-thon a few years ago, where we invited students to come and create or edit entries on Wikipedia where they were adding things that were of interest to them or their own areas of expertise. These have been held in different libraries around the country. There may still be an unofficial Wikipedia day that takes place in different libraries.
On the few times I've used Wikipedia, I've noticed there was on one occasion where it says they're looking for extra references or something or for some kind of clarification. I thought, whoa, I thought you people knew.
Well, everyone has their different areas of expertise, and because there are people who do like to go on there and just kind of say whatever they want to say, they try to have some sort of quality control. But what we always end up circling back to with students is ultimately you don't know who is creating that information. You don't know if they're an expert in the field or if it's just somebody on a whim in their basement. So it's following up on those citations that are provided whenever possible.
So how do you wean students away from just using their phones to Google the answers to things?
What I have started to do and what many of my colleagues in the field are doing is not really weaning them away from starting there, because I'll be honest with you, I consult Wikipedia, right. I consult Google. So rather than trying to fight what people do naturally and what they've learned to do, starting to view it as not the last step, but the first step. How can we use Google more intelligently? How can we think about who is creating the information that we're finding on these different websites? And how do we assign authority to the different bodies or individuals that are creating that information?
You know, my objection to the whole system is that I contend, and I've contended on this program many times, that you're better off not letting a kid touch an iPhone until they're done with a few books. Because getting the answer right away does not give you the inclination, means, or habit of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
What do I want to know? Oh, there's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
That process is very efficient, but I just don't think it helps the brain develop properly.
I've been very pleasantly surprised with how my son has been taught to research so far. In as much as he's in second grade. He's eight. But while they do have certain websites and certain online encyclopedias that they use at their elementary school, the research that he's done, the little research projects about desert animals or what have you, they are still primarily relying on books. So, you know, at least in our school district, it seems like they're going about it the right way. And we are, my family, a little bit Luddite in terms of technology with our student, or our children, I should say. But just because we don't know any differently than how we were raised, and none of this existed 38, 39 years ago, so we're just trying to, you know, keep their innocence a little bit longer, let them explore, let them uncover things in the library as we used to, just by browsing. There's a sense of serendipity that I think is lost.
Is Augie still acquiring, and are there still such things as new reference works?
There are. And in fact, we make a point of being sure to instruct students in how to use the physical reference collection, especially during the fall term, the first year inquiry, and the honors sequence. Again, to kind of remind or perhaps introduce students to the idea of browsing. You know, it's very often where we might not know all of the ways to talk about an idea, but we're limited by our vocabulary. So if we sit down at a computer and just type in the few words that we know, we're instantly restricting the results that we get to the knowledge that we already have. So by encouraging students to go into the reference collection to look at, you know, for example, say they're doing some kind of project where they're using the most recent Augie Reads book, I'll use an example from a few years ago. They were reading James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. So the instinct might be to look at works of literature, look at literary criticism, kind of look at it from the English disciplinary angle. But really, Baldwin is speaking about much more than literature. It is literature itself, but he's speaking about race relations. He's speaking about religion. He's speaking about politics. He's speaking about philosophy. So by encouraging students to think about what other disciplines might be having the same questions that they're having, and encouraging them to look more broadly before they begin to narrow, they'll go down different narrower paths than they would if they had just started with the words that came to their own minds in the first place.
So a student comes up to you and he says, I've got to do a research paper on cattle trails in the West. Without doing that work for them, what do you suggest?
Well, first I have to ask them, why are you interested in researching cattle trails in the West? And I would hope the answer is more than just my professor told me to, hoping that they have some kind of personal investment in the question that they've arrived at. And if they have the flexibility to try to find some kind of personal connection, maybe they're interested in the cattle trails in the West, but they're also interested in what was motivating westward expansion in the first place. So then we're not just looking at, you know, the geography or the history, but we're looking at maybe different political motivations. We're looking at the economy of the United States at the time. We're looking at ways in which the cattle trails of the West have now led to this sort of mythos that we have about the West and the old cowboys and Indians trope and things like that. There's never an end point. There has to be, because the assignment ends up being due. But my goal is always to try to get students to go down enough different paths before they decide that they feel like they've landed on something that they are personally invested in.
So where would you send a student that came up with that question?
Well, a logical point, I try to start with databases, because that's the way that we kind of narrow the wider world of the internet into things that have been collected and vetted, that have been determined to be quote-unquote better resources. But I might not just restrict them to a history database. We have one particular resource that is very multidisciplinary in nature. So you can type in, you know, a keyword search for westward expansion, for example, and find not just the ones that are coming through the disciplinary lens of history, but through the disciplinary lens of literature, from religion, from kind of the flip side of the coin, which would be indigenous studies. How did that affect the peoples that were already there, and how do the ramifications of that continue to echo today?
You know, there was a columnist, Sidney Harris, who would occasionally write, "Things I Found While Researching Something Else." And that is, when you mentioned the thing about reading and going into reference books and so on, it's true. You just keep wandering. You start out with the subject, and then something else catches your eye, and away you go. Before you know it, you've shot the whole day, but you've learned an awful lot.
I did that over and over again with the card catalog. I really missed the card catalog by going too far or not far enough and come across stuff that I didn't know I was interested in.
Oh, yeah.
Card do you still catalog. Have the card catalog?
You know, we do not. I remember
it used to be hidden away in the basement.
It used to be hidden away in the basement. It is no longer even hidden away in the basement.
It's gone?
It is gone.
Sacrilege.
Little pieces of it exist. I have a drawer in my office. There's
from the card catalog?
From the card catalog.
Do you know who full painted the grain of wood on that?
Mm-mm.
Me.
Was it you?
I spent a summer doing the read just before they dismissed the card catalog, making the card catalog look like oak.
Didn't you also make the mace that we carry at the commencement ceremony?
Yes, I did.
I thought of you
yes,
over the
I
weekend
did.
As it was
yeah.
carried down.
I avoided grading papers as much as I could.
As a matter of fact, he just avoided teaching. He was really a woodworker. Under the cloak
anyway.
Of a professor of English. Oh, dear. But that's, the whole business of pursuit of knowledge, of how do you learn stuff? And again, I run across people in the many years I've been talking to folks. I've asked them, how did you happen to get into this? And quite often it turned out to be by accident.
Mm-hmm.
Something happened
mm-hmm.
or something occurred or someone suggested something. And they went herring off on a completely different path from the one they started.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into this business?
It was not my original plan. isn't that always the way? I graduated from Augustana in 2001, and I had degrees in English and in biology, which do not seem to naturally align in any particular career path.
They certainly did with mine.
But I ended up doing educational publishing was my first job after graduation. I worked for Prentice Hall, and I was an editor of non-majors biology textbooks. So if mm-hmm. that isn't the perfect combination of the two things that I thought I was going to be doing. So then it was even more difficult to wrestle with the fact that I was realizing I wasn't enjoying my job as much as I thought I would. And it's not that I didn't enjoy the editing. I still enjoy editing and working with language and working to clarify ideas. But I was in an office in Boston that was kind of a satellite office of the company. So we were largely isolated. I was doing most of my work through phone calls and using Word documents to have conversations. There's a little feature where you can turn on track changes. So I would get the manuscripts from the authors, who were primarily college biology professors, and through the comments that I would add to their words, try to, you know, suss out meaning or, you know, make suggestions or clarifications. But since you're never sitting down face to face with anyone, you're never quite sure how those things are landing. You're never quite sure if you're on the same page, literally and metaphorically. And I found myself trying to convince myself that I was helping college students through the work that I was doing, but college students aren't always a fan of their textbooks. They cost a lot of money, and they're not always things that they feel are necessary. So I knew I was kind of kidding myself, so I kind of started looking through graduate programs, but didn't want to pick either English or biology. I've always liked learning a little bit about a lot of different things. It's why I really enjoyed my liberal arts education. And I didn't want to get a PhD. You know, no judgment upon people who get PhDs. They're very necessary. But I personally didn't think I would be happy devoting that much time to any one little thing in either of those disciplines. So I started looking through lists of master's programs at different universities, and I saw library science. And I thought, I like libraries. Let's investigate this a little bit more. What would that look like? What would that mean? What would my job be? How would I spend my days if that's what I ended up being? And, you know, so then much to my parents' at the time, surprise, I'm sure, decided that I was going to apply to graduate programs in library science. I had never worked in a library. I had never, you know, I wasn't even a student worker who checked out books in the library. I just visited them and have always liked learning things. And it seemed like a profession where I could keep doing that. And I would actually get to work face to face with the college students that I was trying to help. But I knew that in reality, it wasn't exactly what I envisioned it to be.
So you got your degree in library science.
So I got my degree in library science.
Where did you go from there?
I got my degree at Iowa. Mm-hmm. And when I went to grad school, it was always thinking, wouldn't it be great to work at a small liberal arts college like Augustana? And as anyone who spent any time in the Augustana world knows, it's a very small world, even though, you know, graduates get spread out across the country into different areas. When you meet someone who's connected to Augustana, you feel like you know them in some way.
They're part of the tribe.
Exactly. So I was back on campus at an Augustana choir concert. I was in the choir for all 4 years. And I was approaching graduation, but I was going to have my master's degree in December, which on an academic hiring schedule is not the greatest time to be ending your grad program. So I was a little bit unsure of what I was going to be doing. Ran into an old friend of mine from Augie Choir who was currently working at Augustana. He was working in one of the residence halls back when Carlson was still the men's dorm. And he said, well, you know, you should meet my wife, who is the special collections librarian at Augustana. You should just talk with her. Let me introduce you. So I met Jamie Nelson, who was the special collections librarian at the time. And Eric introduced us. And she said, well, you know, I have this grant, and I'm going to be hiring somebody to do some work in special collections, processing this the John Hauberg collection, working on doing some original cataloging of their Native American trade ledgers and their some of their images as well. And I had never thought of going into cataloging, but this was a temporary position. And I was an editor, so I like all of that detail work. And I interviewed for the job, and I kind of got my foot in the door through that temporary position with Jamie down in Special Collections, but was quickly kind of welcomed into the culture of the library, started coming to their weekly meetings and things like that. And lo and behold, one of the librarians was going to be moving away. And there was an opening, and I was able to apply for the job. And they must have liked me because they wanted to keep me. So that was nice.
Well, I can see why you got hired, Anne. You are one articulate librarian. My first experience with librarians, I loved libraries when I was 5, 6, 7 years. You know, my mom would take me down, which was in the basement of the courthouse in our little town, you know, dusty old books and stuff. But as far as I know, the only vocabulary the librarian had was shh.
Oh my gosh, that stereotype.
And that, well, it wasn't a stereotype. It was absolutely
that was a
true,
way of,
right?
That was a way of life.
It was, and it's something that because that is not the way of libraries anymore.
No, absolutely not.
But it's something that is so deeply ingrained in popular culture. You know, even now when you hear the word librarian, you close your eyes and there's this very vivid, specific
yes.
picture
yes.
that comes to mind. You know,
Margaret Hamilton.
Yeah.
Woman
yeah.
of a certain age.
My librarian looks exactly like her.
Woman of a certain age, hair in a bun,
yes.
glasses, you know.
Wearing mauve.
Wearing mauve. And every now and then, it's when I'm pushing a book cart that I feel like I'm embodying that. You know, there's something about pushing the book cart through the library.
I doubt that you could bring yourself to that just listening to you.
I do hate to tell people to shush. We occasionally do. Gets a little rowdy in there during finals week. And, you know, we do kind of keep an eye on things. But it is my least favorite part of the job when it does come to that.
When I was managing the station, sometimes my job would be to quiet down now, please. Generally, you don't like raucous laughter and so on echoing through the building. But that's, you know, it's interesting the shape your life has taken. And it's if doors opened in your mind and in your actions that suddenly led you right to where you are now, mm-hmm. where I assume you are pretty satisfied.
I am very satisfied. And my life path isn't one that I had predicted, but I feel that it serves me well also in my work as a first-year advisor. So many of our students now come to college either thinking that they know what they want to do because it is genuinely what they want to do, and I try to discern whether a student's path is their own or perhaps something that has been identified for them by a family member or by what is going to lead to a job. You know,
right.
A college education is not cheap. Augustana is not inexpensive. So it's very understandable that they want to come out of here with a plan. But do you need to have that plan on day one when you're 17 or 18? No. So much like research, where I don't want to close any doors before I have to, in my advising work, I have much the same mentality where, you know, I encourage exploration. And that's the beauty of the liberal arts program. You have not only the opportunity, but the requirement to take classes outside of the things that you think you're going to end up pursuing. So if you're able to approach those with an open mind and let them change you and let them inform your decisions, you might end up on a different path than you had envisioned for yourself. But it will be perhaps a truer one than you thought you would have in the first place.
You know, I think that's typical, though, to change.
Oh, yeah. Lord, I want to be a doctor, then a priest, then a biology teacher, then in television, then in politics, then back to radio, and now a loafer. You know?
Isn't the end goal loafer?
Well, you know, it is true that life is such an interesting can be such an interesting pattern. If you set your mind on one thing, or if your nature just puts you in one field and you can't get out of it. I've had a couple of friends like that who were predestined to be what they became and could not, I mean, it never occurred to them to try anything different, and they carried that profession right through to the grave. And I often wonder, what is that like?
I talked to a 20th anniversary class quite a few years ago now, but which would mean they were all 40, 41. You can't believe the number of students that came up to me, successful lawyers, city managers, and said, I wish I hadn't done with my life what I've done with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of regrets. Not everybody. I mean, a lot of people are happy and they were successful, but they wish they had, you know, taken this risk or done that.
Well, and I think anybody does that. You know, when I think back over my life, I think, you know, I took this turn. I could have kept on that one. I wonder what would have happened if I had followed this. Because all through your life, you suddenly think, wouldn't that, or at least for me, wouldn't it be interesting to do that? I wonder how hard it is to get into that. And I'm convinced that if you set your mind to it and you have a good library at hand, that you can become an expert in a matter of 2 or 3 years in almost any subject you want if you apply yourself. And I've seen people take those sudden turns in life. I've seen a couple of my kids do the same thing. They head off in one direction. A few years later, zoom, they're off in another and doing quite well and very, very much happier in that second profession. So the path of life is, and you're with people who are starting out, not precisely starting out because the start was much earlier, but college is a critical time. That's when things happen.
Yep.
And I imagine you've seen that a lot.
I've seen it a lot, and I've seen students approach it in very different ways. You know, sometimes it happens to you. Sometimes
right.
You're that pre-med student who, you know, you get to organic chemistry.
Yep.
And that's just it for you. And I say this with full ownership because one of the little forks in my road was, honestly, organic chemistry. I came to Augustana thinking that I was going to go to grad school for biology. And then I was already kind of lukewarm about taking calculus. I wasn't sure about that, but I was going to do it if I had to. And then I hit organic, and it hit my GPA. And I stuck out 2 terms of it. And then I decided, you know what? This is just going to be the end of this road for me. And it was not a quick decision. It was not an easy moment. It was not an easy path to take. But at that point, I realized, you know, I could still get my biology degree without taking organic chemistry. And I still wanted to get that biology degree. I just knew I wasn't going to be able to take it any further down the path that I had envisioned myself.
We belong to the same club. I had organic chemistry. I took 1 class, and that was it. I was done.
And there are some people who just understand it. I remember sitting in my dorm room with a friend of mine, and he just got it. And he would want to study it in this certain way and have these conversations on this level that I was just not at. And I said, you know, we have to stop because I just have to memorize this now.
Yeah.
I cannot explain why.
That's
I just have to
I
memorize
did.
It.
Memorize those formulas. That's it. I must say, yeah, organic chemistry. I got my biology degree, but that was my only brush with chemistry. That was it. I'd had my fill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Anne, I must say it's been a delight talking to you and finding out what a research librarian does. And I envy your students because I think it would be fun to have you kind of steering a course of study for us. But research or not, libraries are great. And thank you very much for stealing out of the library long enough to talk to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that'll do it for today's edition of Scribble. Roll, tweet, and I'll be back next week. And we hope you will, too.